Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
We are announcing roughly $8 billion in loan guarantees to break ground on the first new nuclear plant in our country in 3 decades. The first new nuclear power plant in nearly 3 decades. There will be those that welcome this announcement, those who think it's been long overdue. But there are also going to be those who strongly disagree with this announcement. But what I want to emphasize is this. Even when we have differences, we cannot allow those differences to prevent us from making progress.
No, the all-important word, progress. Now, Obama has tacked to the center here by throwing the construction of two nuclear power plants to the center, and I would say somewhat to the conservative movement. He understands the anger towards him and his party in America. And he knows that the people need a bone, so he's throwing a bone to the people in the form of the construction of nuclear power plants. Of course, I think General Electric will probably get this contract, which explains why vermin such as those you see on MSNBC driveling on with the lowest possible rating remain in business, because they are basically hacks of the Obama administration. But nevertheless, I congratulate the president for doing the right thing. I've been calling for nuclear power since 1994. It's common sense. I mean, even liberal France runs on, 80% is nuclear energy. Germany runs on nuclear energy. Israel runs on nuclear energy. Every advanced nation runs on nuclear energy to a great extent, except this poor, sad sack of a nation which has been held in a lock grip by the verminous, out-of-touch maniacs on the left who prevent any form of progress in any manner, whether it's to the right or to the left. The left wing only wants a communist revolution. They're only spoilers. So I congratulate the president if he actually goes ahead and funds this. This is a great idea. But you know who you have to thank for this? You have to thank basically the town hall meetings and the Tea Partiers, because the anger out there, the rebellion out there, the independent spirit out there, the Tea Party movement, which expresses really all of the beliefs of the conservative populism that I have been expressing since 1994, and others, by the way, is finally filtering through to the Chicago guys. They finally understand there's a revolution going on in this country. And I want to thank them for hearing the people. Now, don't be deceived. They're still plowing ahead with their radical left-wing Marxist agenda. They're going to throw you a bone here and there. But notice the key word in what he just said. It was a code word to the left. He said, can't stop progress. Progress is a code word. You think progress means the development of new technology. You think progress means the progressive movement towards, let us say, a better life for more people. But it doesn't mean that. Progress is a code word for communism as used by Obama and his minions. So this is the only thing Obama's done right so far, and I congratulate him for that. I want to tie this in, though, to a question I received this morning from the editor of the magazine that's going to publish this huge monster interview with me in May, in the May issue. They sent the photographers today, as I mentioned. I'm not going to talk about that. But he said, hi, Michael Savage. I realize we didn't talk about the Tea Party movement. I was wondering if you could share a few thoughts here about it. What are its pros and cons in your opinion? Thanks. And that was the writer for the magazine. So here's what I wrote in between being made up and running in and out of phone calls. And here's what I wrote on my feet. I've always liked tea. This movement is largely composed of middle-class business owners who know the government, Republicans and Democrats alike, are bankrupting the nation. What do they say? Lower taxes and stop spending. It's about the economy. You see, Obama has never met a payroll, never created a product or service. He's had a fund, market, supply, and resupply. By his own admission, all Obama's ever done is push papers. He actually said that in one of his speeches. And so the Tea Partiers see the threat from this Marxist-oriented president, his drive to nationalize many aspects of the private sector, from GM and AIG to our banks and healthcare. They know that global warming and the associated cap-and-trade legislation are a gigantic Ponzi scheme built on false science. In fact, the chief proponent of this climate scam, Phil Jones, admitted on February 15th that the climate data is bogus. He admitted there hasn't been any statistically significant global warming for 15 years, since 1995. They know that this hasn't stopped Obama from heating up his plan to expand federal funding of global warming research, already pegged at $2 billion. The tea parties, the town halls, are all saying what I've been saying on the radio. They are the true voice of America, not the left-wing rent-a-mobs we have seen for the past 30 years. And that's why the Tea Partiers both shock and frighten the left-wing media. These are real people, really angry for real reasons. Michael Savage. So that's what I sent to him, and he said, thanks. Got it. Great. Thanks for the quick turnaround. So there it is. Those are some of the ideas. Now, at the 30-minute mark of this hour, we're going to have something that I have never heard yet in the media, not on Fox News or anywhere else. I haven't seen this fellow, but you're going to hear from him. And that's a man who is going to discuss EMP attacks, the possibility of an EMP attack with the consequences that will so fall. It's a disaster if it happens. What is an EMP attack? It's a suitcase or car-based EMP weapon that could destroy data centers, all electronics in the blink of an eye, crippling our economy, destroying information such as criminal records at the Justice Department, destroying all financial records on Wall Street, etc. Now, what are we going to do about an electromagnetic pulse weapon? How do we protect against it? Because remember, EMP weapons absolutely destroy electronics. So what if it took down electricity in New York City? Medicine would spoil, food would spoil, no communication for first responders, no communication for you. All electronic data records would be destroyed. Hospitals would run out of backup power. And if that's not bad enough, you can imagine the rest. My friends, this is serious stuff. And so we have the leading expert on this concept of protecting against an EMP attack who has advised the FBI, Homeland Security. And he worries about North Korea or Iran, who could detonate a nuclear weapon high above the atmosphere over the U.S. and send us back to the Dark Ages in a second. You hear all of this? Now, I'm not doing it because I just want to shock you and frighten you. I'm doing it because it's important. You got to remember that all of us in the media engage in rhetoric all day long. That's what we do for a living. But some of us understand that beyond the rhetoric and behind the rhetoric, there are consequences. I'm one of those people. And I want to make certain you understand that there are consequences to the actions not only of Obama, we certainly know what those reactions and consequences are, but to our actions and mainly our inactions. By doing nothing, you've allowed Obama to become president. By doing nothing, you've allowed a radical from New York City named David Axelrod to wind up as the chief advisor or the man who runs the White House. Nobody can imagine this would have happened in their lifetime, that basically somebody who would be very comfortable in the ILGW of the 1950s would be running America. But it happened, and it's happened right in your lifetime, primarily because you did nothing. So we're going to talk about these things on the Savage Nation. 1-800-449-8255. We're also going to talk about dogs, because I watched the Westminster Kennel Show last night on television. It was fabulous. Loved it. We're going to talk about the dogs that were there, what your favorite breed of dog is and why. What kind of dog do you think is the most intelligent? And, you know, it's an interesting question. I don't know anyone who doesn't love a dog except, I'm sorry to tell you this, you know, you don't know this. Do you know that dogs are not permitted in fundamentalist Muslim homes? I want you to think about this. If you don't know politics, all you got to do is ask yourself, why do those people hate dogs? They call them dirty. They won't eat. Did you know that the Minneapolis cab drivers, the Somali taxi drivers, the Muslims wouldn't even drive people who are blind with seeing eye dogs? They had to be taken to court to permit seeing eye dogs to go into their taxis. Do you understand why we are threatened by these people? Do you have any idea what we're facing here? Do you understand this is not a group of rogue individuals, an occasional guy like Major Hassan? These are all part of a gigantic movement against your way of life. And if you think your government is helping you in this fight, you are mistaken. The Obama government will not even use the word Islam or Islamist. when talking about terrorism. No, they won't. Are you aware that the TSA forced a four-year-old crippled boy to remove his leg braces at the airport? When I read that story, I wanted to cry and I wanted to smash somebody's face in. A four-year-old boy who wore leg braces, some piece of garbage in the TSA, told his mother and father, take those leg braces off to go through the machine. The mother said, he's never walked. He can't walk. He can't walk. Supervisor said, you know why we're doing this. Get those braces off the kid. The mother begged the TSA vermin, can I walk through the scanner or whatever it is with my son? He's never walked before. And this piece of crap, this minimum wage garbage from the TSA who reports directly to Big Sis, said, no, you may not. He will walk alone. This is your government at work. This is your Obama administration at work. These are the compassionate, kind people who brought you change. This is a little boy named Ryan. He was going to Orlando to Disney World with his father, Bob, a 53-year-old officer in Camden's emergency crime suppression team, and his wife, Leona. And this little boy, crippled boy with leg braces, was taking his first flight to Walt Disney World for his fourth birthday. The boy is developmentally delayed, one of the effects of being born 16 weeks prematurely. His ankles are malformed and his legs have low muscle tone. In March, he was just starting to walk. So, March 19th, his parents of last year wheeled a stroller to the TSA security point. Hours before their Southwest flight was to depart. Hours before. You hear this? So the boy's father took him out of the stroller, broke down the stroller, and put it on the conveyor belt as his wife walked Ryan through the metal detector. The alarm went off. The verminous TSA screener told him to take off the boy's braces. The parents were dumbfounded. They said, he can't walk without them on his own. The vermin from the TSA said, he'll need to take them off. That's your government under Big Sis. The boy's mother offered to walk him through the detector after they removed the braces, which are custom made of metal and hardened plastic. No, said the low-class piece of crap from the gutters of America, who is now wearing a badge and a uniform. The boy had to walk in on his own. The mother was calm. Bob was starting to burn. But they complied with this piece of crap. And the mother went through first, followed by the boy, followed by Bob, so the poor little boy wouldn't be hurt if he fell. But little Ryan made it through. Made it through. The father then demanded to see a supervisor. The so-called supervisor, the $11-an-hour piece of garbage, asked him what was wrong. The father said, this is wrong. This is overkill. He's 4 years old. I don't think he's a terrorist. The $11-an-hour supervisor said, you know why we're doing this. Well, there's more to the story. Of course, the end of the story should be is that Big Sis gets fired, canned, thrown out. She's the head of this agency. You see, if a Muslim had appeared wearing full body covering, I can guarantee you they would have been culturally sensitive to the Muslim. I can guarantee you if a woman appeared with a full body covering, with her head covered in some medieval costume, showing no part of her body, not even her hateful anti-American eyes, these wonderful human beings of the TSA machine would have waved her right through. You see, that's the way America works when you have quislings running the Obama administration. I'll be right back. So there it is. There are some of the headlines that we're going to talk about. Obama approves the construction of two nuclear power plants. And I agree with him. You know, even a clock watch is right twice a day, as they say. It's true. So he's got one already. He's going to be right again once for sure. I wish he was right twice a day. That would make, if a president was right twice a day, any president, we'd be in luck. What you don't understand about politicians in general, it really doesn't matter Republican or Democrat. What you don't seem to get about this whole picture is that most of these people are career bureaucrats. Not all of them, but most of them. Most of them never met a payroll. They've never created a product or a service that anybody wanted or needed. They never saw a product fail and they had to retool the product. They never had to go out and say, well, it's not selling. What can I do to make the product better? Or anything like that. So they keep doing the same thing a government's always do, which is create new bureaucracies hire more of their friends and cronies, give out more patronage jobs, and tax us. That's what the right-wing revolution is about. But you got to understand, this Tea Party revolution is not a right-wing thing. It's a middle-class thing. It cuts across, I would say, the center to the right. There may even be liberals in the Tea Party movement, for all I know. I think they hate government as much because they know what the danger they're putting us in, to be very honest with you. And I'm going to talk about this later on and more over the next few days, but not right now. I want to talk about what we talked about, what we brought up so far. This is a very short segment because I got very worked up over the kid, the little four-year-old with leg braces, being forced to take them off by a big sis's minions down there at the airport. Why weren't they fired? Why were they not fired? Why was the TSA schmuck not fired, and why wasn't the supervisor Putz not fired? I want to know the answer. Yeah, okay, well, you're not going to blame her for it, right? Why not? Why not? It all starts from the top down. The woman has failed us on the Christmas Day bombing. She failed us at the Fort Hood. Now she fails us here. What is she going to do next? She's not qualified to be Director of Homeland Security. Everybody knows that. We need a retired military who's looked down the gun barrel of an Al-Qaeda member who's come back from the war zone and knows the face of hatred. That's who should be running the Homeland Security Department, not some grotesque hack that the Democrat Party handpicked because she would do the bidding of special interests. That's my opinion. Jeff in Pittsburgh, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Sir, how are you? I have to disagree with you on one point, although I agree with you completely on the other aspect. This isn't an Obama problem. That agency is run amok. They're bureaucrats, like you said, that have no accountability. I've seen them abuse people. I travel a lot. I watch them.
Well, you mean the TSA. I've seen them abuse nuns, 80-year-old nuns in wheelchairs, and I've seen them bow down on their hands and knees to Muslims in full-body outfits. You know I'm right.
You're completely
have they right. ever asked the woman in a burqa to take her medieval costume off so they could see if she's carrying a bomb?
They put a 92-year-old man in Myrtle Beach, not a place of danger, a retired veteran of World War II, and they treated him meanly and they yelled at him because he didn't understand their questions. He had the
mental... Wait, hold on. What was the racial makeup of the TSA agent? Was he or she white?
He was white American.
Good. Well, he's a white trash.
Savage.
See, our competitors are racing to create jobs and command growing energy industries. And nuclear energy is no exception. Japan and France have long invested heavily in this industry. Meanwhile, there are 56 nuclear reactors under construction around the world, 21 in China alone, 6 in South Korea, 5 in India.
Well, so Mr. Obama's doing the right thing. He's authorizing $8 billion in loan guarantees to build a new nuclear power plant, which is a good idea. And now we're going to talk about something related to nukes, not directly related to nuclear power plants, of course. And that is the threat of an EMP blast. Many of you know what I'm talking about, and we have an expert on who will explain to you what this is, what the danger really might be, and what we are doing, if we're doing anything, to protect us from our enemies doing this to us. His name is Gail Nordling. He is the CEO and president of Imprimis Corporation. He knows more about this than anybody. That's why we have him on. Mr. Nordling, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Thank you, Dr. Savage. It's a pleasure being on your show.
Please tell the average listener what an EMP blast is and how it could happen.
An EMP blast can come in two different ways. One is from a non-nuclear RF weapon type of device, which can be fairly portable in a vehicle. And another is a nuclear EMP blast, which is a high-altitude nuclear weapon, like one weapon 300 miles up over Kansas, would fry all of the electronics in the U.S. and put us back to the 1800s.
Oh, my God. Well, that's an awful big paragraph. Now, let's go to the first non-nuke. A weapon in a car?
Yes. This technology has really flourished and come alive in the last 10 years. In fact, the United States weaponized that technology. It's being taught at universities. Texas Tech University has the Center for Pulse Power. You can buy devices on the Internet. There are pulse power conferences around the world,
And wait, you mean the conferences on how to send pulses and blow out electronics?
Yes. Now, supposedly, or these conferences are for good purposes. Texas Tech University that teaches this, as an example, works with police departments to be able to stop cars remotely that they're chasing. Of course, once you teach them...
Oh, yeah. Well, sure, it's America where anybody can attend the class or else you'd be a racist or a sexist or something. And so just as flight schools are normally good places to learn how to fly a plane, we all know that our dear friends who committed the 9/11 a travesty on America went to flight schools in America because they couldn't say no. In fact, the president of the flight school in Boca Raton tried to warn the FBI that he was suspicious of these wonderful Saudis taking a simulator training. And the FBI said, we can't do anything because they haven't blown anything up yet. So I would assume that we have some visitors from some of the Muslim countries in these schools learning how to destroy us. Wouldn't you assume that?
Well, exactly. And in addition to that, Imprimis sent two employees to the 17th annual Pulse Power Conference in Washington, D.C. last June. Over 50% of the people there were foreigners.
Oh, what a country. What a nation of imbeciles. And Homeland Security lets anyone waltz into these, huh? Because it's freedom of education, is that it?
Well, it's very public technology. It's available to everyone.
Well, that's nice to know that our friends in Saudi Arabia and Pakistan are learning how to put us out of business and send us back to the Stone Age. How do you stop them from doing it in a car?
Well, how to stop anything in the fact that these devices can basically fry anything with a computer chip in it. So it's it could be a security system, it could be a communication system, a computer server, anything with a chip. And so you need to shield the equipment, put six-sided metal around it, and then you need to filter the lines, the power lines, and the communication lines going in. And by the way, it also causes data corruption because it's...
So let's say it's not a terrorist, but a criminal who wants to wipe out his criminal records, for example, at a court just before a trial. Is that a scenario that's possible?
Well, it certainly would depend on the backup that they have, but yes, not only criminals, disgruntled employees or customers, extremists, terrorists, students, competitors. There's a whole long line of people that could use this technology because it's so readily available.
So let's say a guy runs a business, a lumber company, and it does $10 million a year, and his competitor does $5 million a year, and he's around the corner. He wants to put him out of business. He could hire someone to do this and wipe out his computer system. He'd be out of business, basically?
Well, if he didn't have the appropriate protection or backup, you would be in big trouble if you didn't have your database not only for your customers but all your vendors, suppliers, and everyone else that you did business with.
Oh my goodness. So you are the CEO of a company called Imprimis, and do you provide this kind of protection? Is that what you do?
Yes, Imprimis was formed for the specific purpose of providing solutions for the civil sector, civil businesses. We're trying to make them cost effective so that they're not the military standard and too expensive. The military is already protected against this, but the civil sector is not.
The military is already protected. But what if North Korea or Iran decided to detonate such a weapon over Kansas? Could they do that?
Well, if they couldn't do it over Kansas, they could more than likely do one off the East Coast and West Coast, maybe the Gulf of Mexico, and would accomplish the same thing. They don't need to be very accurate, and that's what has changed the whole nuclear threat completely. Instead of needing thousands of missiles or weapons, they just need one or two or three.
And you're saying it doesn't... So the old scenario of the ICBM, the more recent scenario of a dirty nuke set off in a city... Those are remote possibilities in a way, and they require tremendous amounts of coordination and bypassing Homeland Security, FBI, et cetera. But an EMP blast, you say, they could bring up like in a ship offshore and just fire it off?
Yeah, like, the old expression, a scud in a bucket type of thing. it doesn't have to go very high and doesn't have to be very accurate, but it could do a lot of damage.
That's astounding, amazing. And I'm sure the government uses your advice, I would hope.
Well, the Navy has issued a report that said this is a big problem and the infrastructure should be fixed. The Congressional EMP Commission in 2004 and 2008 issued reports. The International Electrotechnical Commission came up with standards for this. National Fire Protection Association in 2007 has issued a regulation listing this as a risk. And, in fact, even the final report of the Congressional Commission on Strategic Posture in May of 2009 said the United States is highly vulnerable to attack with weapons designed to produce electromagnetic pulse effects, and these vulnerabilities should be reduced as the U.S. modernizes its grid.
Well, you seem to be an engineer. I mean, you're an engineer, an attorney, a risk manager. You know you're an expert witness. But I noticed in what you just said to me, the answer to my question is I didn't hear you say, yes, the U.S. government has hired you.
Maybe indirectly. We've been talking and working with Congress to pass legislation, and as a direct result of Imprimis's efforts, the bills in the House and the Senate to require the utilities to remediate against cyber intrusions has been amended to include nuclear EMP, non-nuclear EMP, and also solar storms.
Well, Mr. Nordling, who in the Senate or Congress is most receptive to your message? Who's smart enough to understand this?
We've been talking to both sides of the aisle, and both sides have been very receptive. Joe Lieberman is heading it up in the Senate.
God bless him. See, Lieberman at least listens and takes a nonpartisan position where it makes sense. We have to respect that. Have any Democrats lined up and heard you?
Actually, yes. Yvette Clark from New York, she's chairman of the Subcommittee on Emerging Threats, and Penny Thompson, who is chairman of the House Committee on for DHS Homeland Security as well.
Well, thank goodness they're listening. I'd rather see the money go for EMP research rather than ACORN, and that would certainly give us a little more bang for the buck, or shall I say a little less bang for the buck. I don't know which way to put that. But is there anything that the listener to this program who may not have heard about EMPs unless they were experts in this before this show today, what can they do to make sure that this is fast-tracked in Congress?
Well, I think they need to contact their legislators. And the current bill numbers are House File 2195 and Senate Bill 946. And they should call and
well, hopefully, I'll put that up on my website. Do you have a press release on this that we could get? And I'll put it on my website because I want to promote this. I think EMP is a real threat. I've heard about it for years. I didn't know exactly what it was. But you brought up something new today, which is this idea of I can't believe this, a suitcase or car-based EMP weapon? Just before you leave us, what in the heck would be a suitcase or car-based EMP weapon? What would it be? I mean, what kind of weapon is that?
Well, as an example, what makes a great weapon is commercial radar. So a commercial radar set with a focusing cone in the back of a pickup with a fiberglass topper on it, some of those devices are powerful enough to fry electronics for hundreds of feet, so someone could be in a parking lot or a block away and cook all the electronics in the building.
Well, let's say I have a boat with a marine radar on top of it that has a 200-mile radius. Is that a powerful unit?
It can be.
I'll make sure not to eat any ice cream cones near the radar tower. I don't want to accidentally project any radiation towards anyone's data center. Of course, I'm being comedic in the political arena here because this is all new to me. I don't even like running my radar. I'm always afraid I'm cooking my brain when I do.
Well, for the remediation for the civil sector, Imprimis, you may be interested to know, is looking into or is about to complete a wide range of things, from detectors to protected power modules, data modules so people can protect their data, to protect generators, chillers, and we're also also launching what's called Project Prepare USA, which is a website that's going to help families and employees of companies through a crisis if an event like this occurs, because even if we start remediating against this right now, it's going to take a number of years, so we are certainly vulnerable for some period of time to...
Do you send people out? Let's say I have a business. Would you send somebody out and say, okay, here's how we harden your computers? Is that what you would do?
Yes. And in fact, we've taken an approach that will make it much quicker and simpler for most businesses, and that's why it's more cost-effective. You know, as an example...
Oh, you know, there's so much more I need to learn, Mr. Nordling. I think we should have you back another time. This is Mr. Gale Nordling, CEO and President of Imprimis. We've been talking about an EMP blast and what it could do to you if you're just running a computer business out of your home, or let's say, God, much worse than that. I would love to have one of your people come out to one of my radio studios and harden it, so if there is an EMP blast, I can continue to broadcast.
We would love to come out and talk to you.
Well, I hope my producers will be in touch with you. Perhaps we can arrange that. In the interim, what is the best website? Is it www.emprimus.com, emprimus.com?
That's right. And then this other website that we are launching, too, is called Project Prepare USA.
Well, that's a lot of information because you're a man with tremendous amounts of knowledge, and I'm glad we had the opportunity to meet with you, Mr. Gale Nordling, on the Savage Nation. We'll keep tuned in to what you're doing.
Very good.
Thank you very, very much for your appearance today. You know, normally when it's 48 minutes after the hour, running late, normally when a guest appears, I love when the host says, thanks for your time. I mean, guests are dying to go on shows. Oh, you know, thanks for your time. But in this case, I really mean thanks for your time, because I learned something that I didn't hear on television, didn't hear on radio. You say, well, I got enough to worry about. Who's going to worry about this? And I understand that. There's only so much you can worry. You know, I spoke to a guy yesterday. I'll give you another homespun story. Again, a true life 101. He's an Israeli. He went home to Israel for a bar mitzvah, and he's a hardworking man. He came back, and he was away 3 weeks. I said, well, what's the climate in Israel? Are they worried about Iran? Are they worried about Hezbollah? He said, they don't give it a second thought. I said, what? He says, all we read about. I said, all we read about here is Iran, Hezbollah. He said, they never give it a thought. I said, what do you mean? He said, that's how Israelis are. They said, they'll deal with it when it happens. So I understand that. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Toy dogs play a role that is much larger than the dogs themselves, for they are the true companion animals.
Yeah.
They've been selectively bred for size and often for great style.
Yeah,
despite their small size, many of them are first-rate watchdogs, quick to announce the approach of strangers. They are intelligent, responsive, loyal little animals, and fill their job with great enthusiasm.
Here we come, little guys.
Group, the little guys, you can't tell them that.
They all think they're big guys.
Not one in this group believes that they are the little guy.
No, I can tell you that from the living with Teddy, Westminster Kennel Dog Show. I love watching it last night. And I have one of these little guys, and believe me, he doesn't think he's a little guy, and he's a hell of a watchdog. He really is. In fact, today when the photographer was here and his assistant and a makeup artist, he was so careful in guarding me, but he was the star of the show today. You know, they took pictures for hours, an hour and a half, and I said, all for one picture? He said, well, it'll be three or four together. First the formal with the jacket, the next, please go relax. And I had, you know what I did for the last few pictures? I said, let me hold Teddy in my lap next to the microphone. I said, because he's normally here in the radio show. That's going to be the picture you're all going to love. This dog is the star of the show, and he's a toy poodle, so to speak. But that's neither here nor there. What I'm saying is I can't sit worrying about an EMP blast and Iran and the TSA and the Quislings in the government day and night. You know, you have to lead your life. So last night, so after watching the Westminster Dog Show, I watched more television to show you how exciting my life can be. I went to some channel I've never seen, and I wind up watching the Mardi Gras coming out of Rio de Janeiro. I never saw anything in my life like this. It looked like there were a million people on the street in stands. I never saw anything like it. The costumes were something out of nature itself. I don't care who the director is in Hollywood, no matter how great he was, like a Fellini. Fellini could learn from the costume makers in Brazil for the Mardi Gras. And I said, look how different societies can be. You know, here's a planet with 5 billion people. And, you know, you start to think, oh, your view is the only view and your worldview is the worldview. And it is for me. It's how I look at the world and millions of Americans look at the world. But you look at the people in Brazil. I mean, basically, I mean, what do they it's like? It's a life of hedonism and paganism in reality. But it looked like a wonderful life to me. Now, who's to say that they're wrong? We're going to condemn a whole nation because they dress up in feathery costumes and dance in the street, stoned out of their mind? I mean, I don't know what Brazil produces, but they seem to have a good time at whatever they're doing down there. I said to myself, laying in bed at 10 o'clock at night, wondering why I wasn't in Rio, dancing in a feathered boa in the streets. And here I am sitting before the microphone today on the Savage Nation. I go to my callers. First up, this segment, Terry in Washington, D.C. on WTNT. Welcome to the Savage Nation. Terry, go ahead, please.
Thank God you're not in Rio. I just want to say that this has been, this last talk that you just spoke about, this Imprius, this show is better than the God-given nature sex show that you had a couple of weeks ago. You know, your naturally given sex drive.
Wait, oh, you mean my sex drive or talking about what is there a thing called sex addiction?
That was so fabulous. Yes, exactly.
You know, more women have written through back channels to me about the whole show on is there sex addiction. It seemed to touch a chord with a lot of women who really loved that show. So you're saying on the other side of the brain, you love this show as well.
I did. My son was a Green Beret, and on September 11th, he nearly lost his mind because he was waiting for the second wave. We got together.
Stay on the line. It's the Savage Nation right here on your local affiliate.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Scotland and England, the Border Collie is the premier herding dog. Their ability to manipulate sheep is legendary, as is their prowess in obedience and agility. Although easily trained, they are so highly motivated to work, they are perfect for the farm, but not for apartment dwelling, unless provided with outside activity.
Sounds like me, I'll tell you the truth. Okay, let's hear a little music. Outside activity for the Savage Nation. And welcome to this Savage Nation. We are talking about dogs of one kind or another on the Savage Nation when you think about it. Some dogs work, some dogs don't work, some dogs think that their job is to boss around other dogs. In other words, the world is just Animal Farm. And of course, you know the phone number and you know the topics we've been talking about. If you just tuned in, you missed a great guest on the EMP possibilities of an enemy or a terrorist. A suitcase or car-based EMP weapon could absolutely destroy data centers and wipe out all electronics in the blink of an eye, crippling our economy. We talked about that. We talked about tea parties. We talked about dogs. We talked about, oh, so many different things. And you can join the fun. Any topic in the news, frankly, is a topic I'd like to talk about. I mean, the red hot scam unravels, says Wesley Pruden, about the global warming hysteria on which the Obama administration wants to base new tax burdens. We all know that it's fake, but that won't stop them, as you well know. It won't stop them because there's too much money at stake, and they're going to try to railroad us with that one. By the way, I'd like to report that Obama has made a new Muslim envoy to the Arab world. That, you would say, is very good to reach out to the Arab world, but you don't know that Obama's Muslim envoy praised the jihad supporter Al-Aryan. Rashad Hussan said that Sami Al-Aryan, who aided a Palestinian terrorist group, was the victim of politically motivated persecution. So there it goes again. The middle name Hussein that we weren't allowed to mention during the debate for the presidency because McCain said don't mention Hussein. Of course, that's why the fall guy lost. We weren't allowed to mention the word Hussein. And I thought it was a very big issue. If a man's name is Barack Hussein Obama in an age of terrorism where the terrorists are Muslim, I mean, you say, well, wait a minute, where do your loyalties lie? Why can't you ask that question, Mr. McCain? What if your name was John Christ McCain? You think that somebody would have said, does your middle name influence your politics, Mr. McCain? And we would have said, hush, hush, my darling, don't even raise the issue. The media would have said, no, but it's very important because his middle name says Christ. And we have to know where his loyalties lie. Do his loyalties lie to Christ or to America? You know that your friends in the media, the cockamamie boys from NYU, would have said that. You know all of the D students who went to journalism school because they couldn't do anything else would say that anyone whose middle name was a Jesus or Christ couldn't be trusted to be a real American. But when it came to Hussein as a middle name for Obama, that was another story. That's why TSA forces a four-year-old boy with leg braces to take his leg braces off, but doesn't force a throwback wearing a full body covering called a burqa to take it off at an airport. You see? That's what works when you have everything upside down, Alice in Wonderland. You get it, people? I'm sure you got it, people. I'm sure that's why the people are up in arms. I'm sure that's why the people are up to here with the lies and the incompetency. The people know more about how to run a government than the government does. Why do you assume that people in government know more about how to run a country than you do? I personally think that people know more about how to run a country than the government does. Because you actually run the country. You create the jobs, you create the taxes, and these schmucks who never created a job have never created a job. You say, well, wait a minute, they're in charge of 400,000 people. They didn't create those jobs. They stole your tax dollars and made jobs up that no one needed. Have you ever heard of them firing anybody, like firing the TSA supervisor and the TSA agent who made that four-year-old boy take off his leg braces? No. No, you haven't heard any of that. And that's why the people have created these Tea Party movements. Now, even the New York Times has recognized with a sniff. Their article is Tea Party Lights Fuse for Rebellion on Right. That's the New York Times, February 16, by David Barstow. And where do they go? They go to Sandpoint, Idaho, the home of the Aryan Nation, to talk about tea parties. I think they should just as well have gone to Staten Island or Brooklyn or Oakland, California, and talked about it. No, they had to go to Sandpoint, Idaho, the home of the Aryan Nation, to try and smear the entire Tea Party movement, which is why, of course, the New York Times is out of business. Why, of course, the government, like the New York Times, is out of touch with reality. 1-800-449-8255. MichaelSavage.com. 1-800-449-8255. What do you want to talk about? Senator Gillibrand in New York State is going to appear on a panel next to the disgraced former advisor, the Marxist Van Jones. Remember Van Jones? He was thrown out by Obama. Senator Gillibrand is going to appear on a panel next to Van Jones. And she's running for office and wonders why the people don't trust her and don't like her. You know, these people are so out of touch with reality. Here's some more good news. New poll. Signs of real vulnerability for boxer. Ugh, shocking. This is from the LA Times. For the second straight month, the three-term senator, Barbara Boxer, the little feisty girl from Brooklyn, is unable to break the 50% mark against any potential Republican opponents. I could beat her. I don't want to be a senator. I could run against Barbara Boxer and win. I'm positive. Despite all the baggage I would bring, all the things that they say I said, some of which I did say and some of which I didn't, I would say most of the people would actually agree with what I said. I could win for the U.S. Senate in California if I wanted to run for office, but I don't. I want to be very clear. There's no mystery to me why. The woman is incompetent. The woman is out of touch. The woman is a far-left big mouth. Of course she's vulnerable. All we need is a real conservative candidate who knows how to do it, someone who has the ability to move the people like me, but I'm not running. So I'm going to run right to the callers on the Savage Nation. Let's start in my hometown of San Fran, Cisco. I'm trying to be good. I'm trying to say, I can't even say it anymore. I'm going to practice. San Francisco. No. San Francisco. Nope. Karen, San Francisco. Welcome to the Savage Nation from 860 on the dial. Go ahead, please.
Well, Michael, it's actually Concord. I'm not in San Francisco.
Well, good. I'm glad you're listening to me on my new affiliate, though. That's the main thing.
Absolutely. Hey, I called about dogs. I'm actually responding to the report that you had about lawsuits being brought against cab drivers who
yes.
not take guide dogs blind.
You mean Muslim cab drivers, don't you?
I do mean that.
Yeah. Don't be afraid to say it. In Minneapolis, the Muslim cab drivers who came from Somalia, who didn't want to become Americans, whose sons are training to become jihadis in many cases and going back to kill us, to learn how to kill us, the very same wonderful people in Minneapolis who won't take guide dogs for the blind in their cabs, even though they came here begging for asylum, are committing a federal crime against blind people. You're not telling me it's going on here in the Bay Area, are you?
Yes, I am, sir.
Wait a minute. You got in a cab and the driver said no dogs?
Yes.
Well, you have an obligation to write down, oh, you're blind. That's terrible.
Well, here's the deal. Out here in the Diablo Valley, the cab drivers, all the cab companies line up at the BART station. And I'll get off BART and try to get a cab home because sometimes I don't like to wait for the buses out here. They're terrible. So
what are you saying? You have a guide dog for the blind at all times?
Yes, I do. I have.
All right, so you don't even know if the cabs are pulling away. Is that what you're saying?
I don't. I have to find the first one. And the rule is you have to find the first one and ask the first one. If the first one turns
you. So wait a minute. Are you telling me when you're waiting online, can't you ask another person to please help you get a cab?
Yeah, and I have.
And what happens?
But when I come to... The thing is, they want the first one, the fare to go to the first one available. So I'll be a good girl and go to the first one available. And the Muslim cab driver invariably says, I don't want a dog in here. And he
okay, he's committing a federal crime. He should lose his cab license, and he should go to jail. How's that? Does that work for you?
Well, that works for me, but how about another count? They start talking Farsi in front of me.
Isn't it wonderful how they all come here to become Americans and they bring their despicable behavior from their home country to this country, their hatreds, their biases, their prejudices, and the liberals look the other way and turn a blind eye to them? Karen, I have no answer for you other than I wish to God somebody online, a good Samaritan, would help you get into a taxi with a camera in their hand. And the next time one of these wonderful immigrants says no to you because you have a seeing eye dog, his picture is taken and a picture of his license, and it is reported to the FBI and to proper authorities. Thank you for the call. Of course, under Barack Hussein Obama, I think it'll be filed in the wastebasket. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. What do you want to talk about? Small dogs, big dogs, that dog, my dog, your dog, her dog, his dog. San Francisco. Lance, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Dr. Savage, these breeds have been developed through the years for specialized purposes, and I think we need a new breed, the Borders Language and Culture Collie.
Oh, you're talking about dogs. Instead of a border collie, a Borders Language and Culture Collie. That's hilarious. Maybe I could say to people when they ask me what kind of dog Teddy is, I say he's a Borders Language and Culture poodle.
Well, so if he could become a seeing-eye dog, then when Karen has the problem with the Farsi talking in the cab, then the Borders Language and Culture Collie could alert her to the problem.
Of course, Somalis don't speak Farsi, so she's dealing with Iranian cab drivers who won't let her in. Iranian Muslims, I suppose.
The dogs and just move on.
I don't even want to comment on it. I know this. It's a violation of federal law to deny a blind person with a seeing eye dog access to a taxi. And any piece of garbage who does that should be arrested, their license seized, and their assets seized and thrown out of the country. Does that work for you?
Sounds good. Who will enforce?
There you go. That's all. I'll be right back.
Savage.
The Belgian sheepdog was used during World War I on the battlefield as a message carrier, ambulance dogs, and for pulling machine guns. The breed was first seen here in 1907. True to their origins, they continue to be successful herders, as well as excelling in many current competitive activities.
You know, it's interesting that dogs work. They're working dogs. You watch a show on nature. Like, I love nature shows. Science Channel, they showed 6,000 feet below the sea creatures that I never knew existed. Every one of the creatures below the sea has adapted over the eons to some form of capacity to hunt for its food, to hide from the predators that want to eat it. Every single creature in the ocean is either prey or predator to one species or another of another kind of sea organism. And the point of the story is that every animal on Earth works to both protect itself and find its own food, except man. Man may be the only animal on Earth that relies upon others to feed it and gives others nothing in return. And that's why we are resentful of a government that seems to be more concerned about the freeloaders than about those of us who provide the income for the freeloaders. You think this is all hot air and rhetoric? You are mistaken, my friend. Do you know that over 60% of Americans receive more benefits than they pay in taxes? That means 40% of us support 60% more of us. That means that it's an insupportable structure. Did you hear what I just said? Why on earth should we support able-bodied people? Why should we educate and provide medical care for illegal aliens and their children? Why should prisoners be given such glorious treatment in prisons where it costs $50,000, $60,000 or more a year to give them everything under the sun? Special religious meals and books. I didn't say turn it into a devil's island, but I would say something is wrong with a country that is so led by the liberal left that we are bled until there's nothing left in us to give. And I learned from nature. I'm still working at my age. I could have retired a couple of years ago. There were times I couldn't have, but there are times that I could. Why do I keep working? At this point, it's in my blood. It's in my blood. That's all there is to it. I was raised to work. I was thinking about this the other night to tell you this on the radio. What do you mean I was raised to work? Someone beat me with a hose? No. What do you mean I was raised to work? I'll tell you exactly how, in case you want to know how to raise your children. I thought about it the other day. As I get older, I start thinking back on my childhood a lot. My mother and father, if they were to talk about someone in the neighborhood, in the building, and we grew up in the Bronx, they would say, oh, he's a hard worker. They would say it with almost a whisper, looking up to him. Didn't matter what he did. They said, Joe is a painter, but he's a hardworking man. In other words, they said it with respect, the way they said it. So I learned that they respected people who worked hard. That was an important thing in my development, I realized, looking back. In other words, they weren't doing it for me. They didn't say, oh, let's show young Michael how to grow up and who to become. They respected people who worked hard. And they had no respect. They had just contempt for leeches. I don't think they knew any. There was not a person in the building who didn't work hard. Everybody worked. Everybody raised the family. The children were clean. They were all well fed. They were all poor, but nobody knew they were poor. The apartments were clean. And long after we were left the neighborhood, another generation moved in from a different country of origin. And they were a little different. They burnt they were on welfare. And they burnt their mattresses and threw them out of the window into the streets if they didn't get fed. You know, sort of like you'd see at a zoo on a Monday. And you wonder why there's anger in this country? How did this happen? How did a whole nation of hardworking people get taken over by a nation of leeches? And a government that caters to the leeches, not the people who give them the money to give to the leeches. How does this happen? It's unnatural. It's insane. So you want to know what the Tea Party movement is about? You want to know what conservative talk radio has been about? You want to know what my best-selling books have been about? You want to know what the town hall meetings have been about? You want to know why the politicians and the reporters look like deer, you know, in the so-called searchlight? Because they saw real people really angry with real knowledge of what the hell is going on. They know that they've been had and they don't want it anymore. They're not going to take it. There is a revolution brewing in the country. And right now it's a peaceful revolution. But I can warn you, if the people are not heard, there will be a talk show host, not a revolutionary. Make no mistake about it.
Savage.
You're listening to the Savage Nation. I'm the Barber of Seville to the Barbarians on the Hill. Just give me a minute, please. Listen to this. From a dead white male. Imagine what we have now, whiny chick music and crack music, wherever you turn. Listen to the end of this. Listen to how this mind worked. It brings me to tears to think that there were minds on the planet like this. Listen to how he builds this. Listen to the mind. Okay? Just let yourself go. Go with it. Okay, here we go. Probably heard this, but you didn't know who it was. Higher, he takes you higher, 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 higher. Higher. But you can't stand it anymore. So we have gone from the Barber of Seville to the Barbarians on the Hill. This is the Savage Nation talking about all of those things. You know, you listen to Rossini's Barber of Seville. I heard it the other day in a car. I said, I got to play it for a minute, take a chance. Look how fast this man's mind could be. Listen how fast it was. Pre-drug mind. And you have musicians today, so-called musicians. They're basically barbarians faking it as musicians. Everything is ersatz, the painting, the music, you name it. A collapsed, broken society with false idols everywhere you turn, whether they're false preachers or false musicians, whatever, false scientists, whatever you want to do, wherever you turn. Ersatz, you know what I'm saying? Mayonnaise, not butter, whichever way you want to look at it. Margarine, not butter, whichever way you want to look at it. Olive-like, not olive, you know. And you ask yourself, how did this happen? How did the people become so denatured and It's mystifying, actually, to think. It doesn't happen overnight. So if you think you're going to turn it around overnight, you're mistaken. When a thing like this happens to a society, it doesn't turn around overnight just because you know it, or because a million of us know it, or 10 million of us know it, or 30 million of us know it. You got to remember, it's a world of 5 billion people. Most of them live in the darkness of getting and spending. The darkness of getting and spending. The darkness of buying and selling. The darkness of entertaining themselves and shopping. The darkness of looking at sluts in Hollywood as the role models, not Martha Washington. The darkness of looking at fakers in Hollywood who are pretending to be heroes when the real heroes of the world are never seen nor heard, whether they be in Afghanistan or in Iraq or in a hospital room or at a ward for crippled children. You never see these people. And so we live in the darkness. That in some ways it's worse than the darkness in the Middle Ages. In some ways, although we are certainly better off physically than our ancestors were, although that's debatable unto itself, would you say that we live in the light, living in a society that we live in today? You know, you look at men in the suburbs, the white suburbs. You say, oh, that's the lily white suburbs. It's all good there. And I see men with children and wives. They're probably decent people. They dress like boys. I just look and I don't understand it. How can a grown man walk around with shorts, I ask myself, and a hat on backwards pushing a stroller? Does he look at himself in the mirror? I mean, I'm not the sartorial expert of the world, but there's something in that image that I feel as though like from another planet sometimes. A grown man pushing a carriage wearing shorts and a hat on backwards trying to look like an 11-year-old boy. How does this happen? The father looks like Beavis and Butthead. Anyway, from the Barber of Seville to the Barbarians on the Hill was the little quip. Now we're going to play the Brandenburg Concerto by Johann Sebastian Bach. And think how we've fallen from the Brandenburg Concerto to crack music and whiny chick music in department stores in just so short a period of time. And you're telling me the dead white male has nothing to teach you? I would argue to the contrary. Let's hear a little bit of the Brandenburg Concerto so you know what greatness is. Does the mind still hear this? Does the American mind still hear any? I don't know anymore. Am I allowed to come out from behind the curtain? Can I come out from behind the image? Am I allowed to show this side of myself to you, the people, the listeners, the wonderful listeners of the Savage Nation who have given me so much love, respect? Dare I play a thing like this and tell you how it breaks my heart to play it? To think that we live in a debased society where goons from the gutters are held up as role models for your children to look at. Goons from the gutters held up as musicians when they are nothing. They're not musicians. Goons from the gutters held up as artists by con men in the record companies and the movie companies. Goons from the gutters held up as role models, and you wonder why every minute they pull out a gun and shoot each other. You wonder why boys pull out a gun and shoot each other at a moment's notice because goons from the gutters are held up as role models. You're taking your son to a concert to hear the Brandenburg Concerto? Of course not. That's not a concert. A concert is a bunch of drugged, stoned out sex maniacs throwing themselves around on the ground. That's a concert today. Yeah, all right, say it's just the rantings of an old man. What do I care what you say? You know, I'm as much a hedonist as the next man. I can enjoy myself as much as you can, I can guarantee you. I know how to enjoy myself. I know how to have a drink. I know how to have a good time, believe me. But that doesn't mean I have to roll in the mud with the pigs in order to have a good time. And it means that I can tell you when the pigs are rolling in the mud of your mind, if you don't mind. That's all I'm going to say on the matter. Just play it for a minute, and I'll come back to my reality here of politics as usual. The Savage Nation. Politics as usual, the barbarians on the hill running our lives. Big Sis in charge of Homeland Security, stripping the braces off a four-year-old boy. Big Sis in charge of Homeland Security. Defense Secretary Robert Gates saying, I'm not going to go there when the word Muslim came up. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff saying he's worried about the consequences of an attack on Iran, not knowing which side they're playing for. You don't know which side of the what team are they playing for? You don't know it. We don't know it. There's nothing clear for us anymore. The government is confusing us by telling us that they don't know what to do except to control us, not the enemy. Yeah, bring in more Muslims so they can become cab drivers and deny blind people and their seeing eye dog the right to a taxi ride, and then protect the Muslim cab driver, saying it's his religious right. Don't you understand what's happening to your country right in front of your eyes? Because you let liberalism, the mental disorder, take over the nation? That is why we're losing it all. It's a philosophy, Jake. It all starts with a philosophy. As so many times have I quoted Blake, the great 19th century poet who said, the eye that alters all does all. Don't you remember that quote? And I'm trying to say it to you because I'm not trying to prove how smart I am. Listen to what Blake was saying. The eye that alters, alters all. Once the eye is altered, meaning if you're a little nuts, everything is altered. And so we have a government now with altered eyes that have altered all. That's what he was trying to say. They may as well all be on LSD for how they're treating the people of this country. They may as well all be stoned out of their minds on some kind of drug. Which is not to say they are, but they may as well be, because their altered eye is altered all. That's what we, the people, are trying to say to them. The people know more about their lives than the government does. The people know more about a balanced budget than the government does. The people know more about not taking in any more immigrants than the government does. The people know more about these things than career bureaucrats who have never created a product or a service that anybody ever wanted. Because if they did, they would be on a welfare line themselves. They would never have produced the product anybody wanted, and that's why they're in government. And so they continue to produce services nobody wants with your money. And now you wonder why people are angry? Why there's a rebellion in this country? You can call it a right-wing rebellion if you want to target the right. I don't care. Say what you want. I'm proud to say it's a rebellion on the right, but believe me, it's a rebellion from the middle. That's the one thing the New York Times didn't get right in that article, amongst others. Tea Party lights fuse for rebellion on right. It's not a rebellion on the right. It's a rebellion from the center. This is a rebellion of the middle class. This is a rebellion of Joe and Sarah. This is a rebellion of people who have worked hard all their lives, and they've lost their jobs, they've lost their houses, and they don't know why. And they see fat cats on Wall Street getting bailed out by Obama, who talks the talk but doesn't walk the walk. A man who says he's for the little people and supports the big people who put him in office. A man who says he's for taking on the banks when, in fact, it's the banks who took him and put him into the presidency. It's a man who says he's for balancing the budget when he breaks the budget. It's a man who deals with the biggest money trader on planet Earth, who could break the dollar overnight and then say, whoops, I don't know how that happened, even though I just had dinner with him, because he visited the White House 35 times, according to the White House logs. So we're not so stupid. It's the age of the internet. Most people know what's going on. It's not 1950, you know. Suddenly it's not 1967 either. And that's all I want to say about that, and I'll be back.
Savage.
You know, you can say a lot of things about Michael Savage, but one thing you can't accuse me of is not giving it my all. Let's put it to you that way. You know, when I get up here, I give it everything I have every day, and I have for 15 years. It's pretty amazing when you think about it. It doesn't mean you have to agree with me or even disagree with me, but I'll tell you something. You're going to get your money's worth for listening to the show. Of course, you pay nothing, but that's your money's worth. So if that's what you say it's worth, that's okay to me, as long as you understand that I'm giving you, you know, reason to tune in. I mean, it's a very competitive business. When I started in 94, there was almost nobody doing this. Rush was around. There was really nobody else in conservative talk radio. And he's still around, does a good job. It's not the kind of show I do or would do. I'm not a Republican. I never have been. I wouldn't be a Republican hack for all the money on earth. But him and Hannity have made a career of that. Apparently, there's enough Republicans out there who think that we need more Republicans. I'm not in that school. Let's put it to you that way. I believe that we're going to have the same crap we had under Bush for 8 years if that's what happens. I don't think the Republican Party is capable of learning a damn thing. I think the two-party system is the problem, and I think that the party system unto itself is frankly unconstitutional. If you want to really get into it, has anyone discussed that? Is the party system constitutional? Was it Jefferson or Washington who warned us that the party system will wind up destroying the country? One of them did. Washington did. That the creation of political parties will destroy America. Well, you have two bands of special interest, that's all. So don't get me too involved with it because I'm not a member of either band. A wallbanger would be, because this is what his, you know, this is his for. This is métier. This is a métier. This is what he knows. Republicans good, Democrats bad. All Republicans good, all Democrats bad. And apparently, you know, it's worked this way to the egress. P.T. Barnum wrote about wallbanger. I mean, he knew what was coming. He knew what was coming. I try not to be a semblance of that. But look, you know, you can accuse me of that as well. I understand it. I get it. Anyway, let's go to the callers here. I mean, I hope you understand what I'm trying to say to you here. Glenn in New York on WOR. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Is this the great Dr. Savage?
It's the Dr. Savage.
I wanted to comment that, you know, I was listening to J.S. Bach that you were playing. And, you know, it's true that you don't get too many Bachs anymore, but it's also true, you know, you only get a J.S. Bach once every 500 years. Or Mozart once every 500 years.
I totally agree with you. When I listen to Beethoven, and I there's only a few musicians on earth, or composers rather, who have written anything that make me shudder when I'm listening to them, when my mind literally shuts down and I find myself shaking. There's only three or four that do it. One of them is Beethoven, another one is Bach, Rossini did almost in the end of that piece, I've had it happen where I literally have to stop what I'm doing because I start to quiver because my mind shuts down because it's done something to me. Now, isn't that the mark of a great piece of art?
I would say so, but what do you think about 20th century composers like Bartok or Stravinsky or...
Fabulous. Fabulous. I mean, I'm actually a lover of Stravinsky. I'm a lover of Bartok, but, you know, I'm not playing that for a reason right now. But you bring up some good points. I even like some of the more popular music of the 1920s. I mean, I'm not saying only, and I'm not stuck there. But I can get worked up over John Coltrane as well. You know that.
Yeah, of course.
But you're a musical... Are you a person who knows music,
I'm
Glenn?
A composer and a classical guitarist. And two
oh,
of
wow.
my piano pieces got played in Carnegie Hall.
So let me ask you something. Being a man who lives in music, when you're talking with such understanding and worship of Bach and such, and I mentioned Coltrane, and you understood right away that he's in a league of greats. Is that well understood that a jazz musician can be in a league of greats?
Absolutely. Duke Ellington is highly regarded by all musicians.
Hold on, let's play the A-Train. Guys, because listen to this. You ever hear me play the A-Train on the Savage Nation? I mean, you know, this guy play. When you hear the A-Train, listen. So when you hear this piece of music being played, you can feel yourself on a shuttling train under the bowels of Manhattan, correct?
I that's what inspired him. You know how he came up with the idea for that song? He was talking to his main songwriter, and he said, "How do I get to your apartment?" So he said, "You take the A train."
I love it. He didn't take a private limo service. He didn't send him a car. Well, I got off track a little bit today, but I like the statement from the Barber of Seville to the Barbarians on the Hill. Did you like that one today?
I liked it. I love your quips. And your apothegms as well.
I'm sorry, my quips and my what?
Apothegms.
Not my aphorisms.
Your aphorisms, your apothegms, everything that begins with the letter A.
I don't know what an apothegm is. What is an apothegm?
Apothegm is like a clever quip.
So it's smarter than a quip, an apothegm.
That's correct.
So how do you define the difference between an apothegm and a put-down?
Apothegm is usually not a put-down. A put-down, you know, knocks
somebody. So in other words, if I argue with Mrs. Savage and she says, "Don't be so smart," and I say, "I'm not trying to say anything cute here. I'm just throwing you an apothegm."
That would be clever usage of that term.
No, it's very, very interesting. Sometimes I did watch a show recently of two rap artists on YouTube having it was on the world's craziest things or whatever, and they were dissing each other in a rap thing in a barbershop. And frankly, they were trying to outdo each other with, you know, their verbal rap thing, which is very interesting. I didn't understand a lot of the words, but in their world and culture, I guess they were putting each other down by how smart they could throw words at each other. And finally, one got so mad he punched the other guy in the mouth in the middle of it because the guy got the better of him. So you wouldn't say that they were using apothegms. They were using put-downs.
Put-downs. Yeah, I'm not a supporter of the rap movement. I think it's you know, one way that society has gone bad is by rap, and you know, the rap is also supported by the people who sell cigarettes and alcohol. You know, because it's used in the disco, so it has its purpose, but it's not art with a capital A.
Glenn, you're a beautiful soul. I really appreciate it. I wish I had known you when I was a young man, so that we could have been friends. I don't give that compliment very often, but you actually remind me of someone I knew in a long time ago. God bless you in the audience. I'll be right back on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And
now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
I told most of you that I did a interview with a major magazine. It'll come out in May. It's going to be as big, if not bigger, than the New Yorker. Well, today was the photo shoot. I got a letter, actually an email this morning prior to the photo shoot from the editor, the writer, who said, Savage, I realize we didn't talk about the Tea Party movement, and I was wondering if you could share a few thoughts here about it. What are its pros and cons, in your opinion? Thanks. That's the writer. So here's what I wrote him. I've always liked tea. This movement is largely composed of middle-class business owners who know the government, Republicans and Dems, the same, are bankrupting a nation. And what do these people say? Why, they say lower taxes, stop spending. You see, it's about the economy. Obama has never met a payroll, never created a product or service. He's had a fund, market, supply, and resupply. By his own admission, all that Obama's ever done is, quote, push papers. He said that himself. The Tea Partiers see the threat from this Marxist-oriented president, his drive to nationalize many aspects of the private sector, from GM and AIG to our banks and healthcare. They know that global warming and the associated cap-and-trade legislation are a gigantic Ponzi scheme built on false science. The chief proponent of this climate scam, Phil Jones, admitted on February 15th, that the climate data is bogus. He admitted there hasn't been any statistically significant global warming for 15 years, since 1995. The people know that this hasn't stopped Obama from heating up his plan to expand federal funding of global warming research, which is already pegged at $2 billion. The Tea Parties, the town halls, are all saying what I've been saying on the radio. They are the true voice of America. They are not the left-wing rent-a-mobs we have seen for the past 30 years, which is exactly why the media is afraid of them. Exactly why the media is afraid of them. The real people of America shock and frighten the left-wing media. These are real people, really angry, for good reason. And so that's what I sent him today about the Tea Partiers. We also have to focus on the bigger issues involved here. You got to remember that this Tea Party movement has become a platform for conservative populist discontent, and actually it's forcing a Republican revival in a certain way, as you could see by the Massachusetts Senate election, the New Jersey election, the Virginia election. But it's also about the private transformation of ordinary people who were not very long ago not especially interested in politics. And now they say that they fear that they're going to have to brace for a tyranny to take back the government. And there's no question that we in talk radio have urged them on. And we've created millions of new activists. They're buying our books. They're going to michaelsavage.com. They're discovering ideas that really are becoming mainstream. They know that Obama and even Bush have deliberately undermined the Constitution and free enterprise for the benefit of a shadowy international network of wealthy elites. They know this. They know who they are. You know, going on about the Tea Party movement is a very important story, because these movements are typically led by political newcomers who really are traditional Americans who prize independence. And they all tell the same story of having been awakened by the recession. Their families were thrown, you know, adrift by lost jobs, foreclosed homes, and depleted retirement funds. And they wanted to know why it happened and who to blame. And so they listened to Michael Savage. They listened to others on television and radio. And now they are awakening from their sleep. And they understand that it's not just Obama, it's Bush as well. It's the two-party system. And they have a vision of the federal government. And that's at odds with both parties, the way they've been constructed. Most of the people in the Tea Parties would like to get rid of the Federal Reserve. They want to get rid of the federal income tax. They want to get rid of many federal agencies, not to mention stop the bailouts and stop the stimulus packages. They'd also like to eliminate some of the so-called entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Now, the fact is many of these people are receiving some of these coverages. But there's a lot of people talking about tax boycotts, secession from the federal government, states nullifying federal laws, even forming citizen militias. They're all outside the mainstream in that regard, but there's an awful lot of them. So what is the Tea Party movement? There's no single Tea Party. It's hundreds of autonomous Tea Party groups. They vary in size, each influenced by the local history of their area. And we'll have to talk more about this in the future on the Savage Nation. You should know, though, that while the Tea Party is getting all of the attention, as it should, the Tea Partiers, just remember where it all started. It all started where? It all started here on talk radio. Not just Michael Savage, but on talk radio. I watched a movie about the Dr. Zhivago. I had seen the David Lean version years ago with Julie Andrews? No, who was in that? The David. Oh, who? Julie Christie, so beautiful. Like you fell in love with her, right? She played Laura. Who was the lead, the guy? The not Omar Sharif. Omar Sharif, he was great as Dr. Zhivago, but I saw a better version. I don't know. It was on a channel called Oviat. I don't know what Oviat is. It sounds like something to do with ovaries. I don't know where it comes from, but it's a weird channel on cable now, Oviat. It almost sounds like an odd channel, but it isn't. They have all of these wonderful classic movies like Madame Bovary. So this was like an English version. It was so well done about the Russian Revolution and what communism actually brought to the country. The horrors of communism.
Savage.
Well, we've been talking about many things today, including dogs. So I wanted to replay an interview I had with Harris Dunn, the director of War Dogs of the Pacific. I recently talked about an amazing film about the use of dogs in World War II entitled War Dogs of the Pacific. And you can find it at wardogsmovie.com. Joining us now is the director of this documentary, Harris Dunn. Mr. Dunn, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on today.
This is an amazing collection of stories about these dogs. What gave you the idea for this documentary?
Well, I first learned about the War Dogs of the Pacific when I was shooting a documentary for Steven Spielberg and Stephen Ambrose about World War II in the Pacific called Price for Peace. And we were interviewing a gentleman named Bill Putney on the invasion beaches of Guam, and he was telling his story about invasion and that he was a lieutenant of a war dog platoon. And this was the first time I'd ever heard anything about the Marines using war dogs and the way that they used them. And his story was so incredible that just that day on the beach, I just looked over to the director of the film, who was an old friend of mine, and just said, "This is the greatest dog story I've ever heard." And I have a dog at home as well, and so just listening to these stories and listening to the bond between the guys and their dogs and the things they went through, it just really, really touched my heart, and I just felt like, I got to make this movie.
Well, the bond between the soldiers and their dogs was quite a bit different from your average family dog bond.
Yeah, well, without a doubt. I mean, it's something that, it's a bond forged, you know, under combat, and the stakes were so great, you know, and I think it's one of the three dog stories because it's this time that there's this cooperation between man and animal to achieve a common goal, you know, using the dog's, you know, unbelievable, you know, senses, their sense of smell and hearing, to achieve this goal was just incredible. And that's how they really were most effective is when they were used, to lead combat patrols. And the dog and the handler would be on point, and the dog could literally sense or smell or hear a hiding Japanese soldier or soldiers, you know, who were laying in wait trying to ambush them. And that's really what they trained them to do. They just basically trained them to you know, look for people, and you know, whether it's by hearing or by sight, and they achieved that. And that was really how they were most effective. But they were also very effective at night. Standing watch, you know, in a foxhole with the soldier, or, you know, out on an outpost or patrol, out on the outer, you know, out in front of troops and things like that to notify when an attack might come. And so it's really just an incredible story, and I think it was a great success story, especially there in Guam, which was where the second and third platoons were involved, which is the ones who were highlighted in the film.
What kind of successes were credited to these animals, and what kind of losses did they suffer?
They were used mostly to lead patrols and to sense and basically find the hidden enemy as they were moving through the jungles of Guam. And then they did almost 500 patrols, and they were never successfully ambushed. So that's considerable success, you know, and that was just the kind of environment that any way that you could have an advantage by knowing that somebody was out there in front of you before you stumbled upon them was a big advantage. So, you know, they were used to great effect. The Japanese quickly found that, you know, that these dogs were finding them, and so they began to shoot the dogs. And, there was quite a few dogs were killed there in combat as well. So we talk about that in the film.
What happened with the dogs after the war?
Well, after the war, the army euthanized, I think, pretty much most of their war dogs, just because they felt like, because they were trained for combat and they were trained to be aggressive, and they were afraid to bring them back into civilian life. But the Marines got their dogs from private citizens who donated them to the Marine Corps, and they promised them that they were going to give them their dogs back at the end of the war. And so they said, we can't just, you know, euthanize their dogs. We agreed to return them. So they went into a detraining exercise, and then they basically trained, you know, probably 95% of the dogs to lose that aggressiveness and to lose that edge and to be able to be reintegrated into society. And a lot of the guys, a lot of the dog handlers actually had wrote the owners of the dog and requested that they got to keep the dogs because it spent so much time with them and so much time clearly in, you know, in combat and, you know, in intense circumstances, and the bond was so close between them that they, you know, had asked if they could keep the dogs. And some of the families had gotten new dogs by then and felt like that was okay, and they certainly understood that bond that their dog had made with that handler, you know, after two or three years of training and combat and being overseas together, that they felt like it was right that the soldier got to keep his dog.
The soldiers' own stories about their dogs was very touching. It was like watching them talk about their best friends or family members.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, it's not just because this wasn't just a dog. This was somebody that most of the guys had all of the guys said that dog had saved their life. And so they felt like they owed their life to that dog. And so it was clearly not just a pet. I mean, it was somebody who they really felt like they owed their life to this dog. And so they just wanted to have the dog in their life, you know, for the rest of their lives. Plus, you're talking about a dog that was so well trained. I mean, I remember Bruce Wellington telling me, you know, that after the war, he'd walk his dog every night, and he said, "Of course, I didn't have a leash. You know, he wouldn't need a leash because the dog was so well disciplined that he would just do anything he said." So you're talking about, you know, some dogs that were probably as well trained as any dog that's ever walked the earth. You know, in terms of absolutely being disciplined and doing what their master asked. You know, they often had silent signals that they could do, whether it was a silent whistle or, you know, and then they worked off hand signals. And so it was just really amazing, you know, the connection that they shared.
Have we learned anything from this program? Is this still going on?
Well, it's interesting. After the World War II, they basically just dismantled the entire Marine War Dog program. And I know that Putney, he was a lieutenant of the 3rd Dog Platoon. He felt like, gosh, you guys really ought to keep this going. We had tremendous successes. And he was really sad to see it being dismantled. But then I think once in Vietnam, they began using war dogs again, and then it was dialed back after Vietnam. And just recently in Iraq, with the having such problems with IEDs and explosives there, the war dog program was dialed right back up, and it's really in full tilt right now. And so all the branches of service are using dogs, and it's really great. And that's actually what I'm working on now. Is I'm working on a follow up to War Dogs of the Pacific and telling the story of the military canines that are in service today in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Great. When can we expect to see this one?
Well, I'm just begun shooting that film right now, so that'll, you know, I'm hoping in a year I can have it completely shot and edited and ready to go out there. But you know, I screened the film for the Marines at Camp Lejeune, which is where the War Dogs of the Pacific Marines trained their dogs, and got great reactions from the Marines. And then afterwards, I talked to a lot of the canine Marines there, and just heard great stories and how they were making a real difference there, and the bond was still there, and the Marines were all sharing the feelings that, you know, times may have changed, but the, you know, that connection to, you know, the handler and the dog, this, you know, I just thought, well, this would be a great, you know, a great follow-up to that. And, you know, there's a lot of men and women, canine MPs who are out there with their dogs, you know, really making a difference. And I got to talk to other Marines too, just infantry soldiers and Navy corpsmen, been with them on patrol. We're all speaking to, you know, how effective they were.
Well, where can people find your movie?
Well, right now, the only place it's for sale is on Amazon. It was just recently aired on the military channel, and I'm hoping it'll have more viewings on the military channel. And but right now it's for sale on Amazon, and I'm trying to get it out to retailers as well. I'm looking to do that. So it's an independent filmmaker, and I'm just taking this out on my own, so I'm kind of self-distributing it. But I just feel like it's a story that wants to be out there, and I just want these guys' story to be told. And that's really what, you know, started this whole thing is when I met Bill Putney, I really wanted to, I thought this would be the you know, the best war film ever, and it would a great dog story. And I optioned his book, Always Faithful, which is a great story of his experience with Marine war dogs. And I wrote a screenplay, and I was just about finished with the feature screenplay, and Bill passed away. And it really reminded me that the story is going away as each of these guys dies. And I had interviewed Bill, and he'd written his book, but there's so many other dog handlers who didn't have a chance to tell their story. And so I started looking up all the dog handlers I could find and interviewing them and scanning their photos and things like that. And then eventually I started editing it together and made a documentary out of it. But it was really just an attempt to just want to preserve this incredible story.
Harris Dunn, thanks for a very touching documentary, and thanks again for being on The Savage Nation.
Thanks, Michael. I really appreciate you giving some attention to the story, and I just really want whatever I can do to pay tribute to these amazing guys, you know, I'm happy to do.
I'm Michael Savage. We'll be right back.
Savage.
A while ago, I caught War Dogs of the Pacific on the military channel, and I just had to talk about it on my show. Here was my reaction to this very well-done documentary. I was talking about War Dogs of the Pacific, where U.S. Marines teamed up with dogs, largely Doberman Pinschers and those incredible other dogs, to hunt out the Japanese in Guam, Saipan, Okinawa, and Iwo Jima. Now, these are rock-hard men. These are the best and just the best men America has ever seen, and we still have many of them, believe me, in the military. The best men in the world, and that's why I supported them when Bush permitted them to be hung out and dried with false court martials. Some of them are still hanging out there. I gave my own money. Many of you contributed money to Colonel Chesani's cause because Bush could have pardoned them. He never did. Instead, he pardoned drug dealers and other criminals. It's unbelievable what these two administrations have done to our military. So when I look back, when I watch these documentaries of World War II, and I see the faces, these are ordinary Americans fighting the hardest kind of fight there is, you know, hand-to-hand combat, smoking out the Japanese in caves, also very hard men. And you reach a point where you see the dogs. Now, these guys are now doing jungle fighting. They're afraid of snipers, Japanese snipers. A man's senses can only see and hear and smell so far. But a dog's senses are hundreds of times greater, obviously. So a dog is, I think, 400 times greater sense of scent than a man. Never mind the hearing, okay? So they're in the jungle now. They're creeping along, hoping they don't get killed from a Japanese sniper, let us say, on Okinawa or Iwo Jima or Saipan. And they need a dog. So they got the dogs now. The dogs now are let go, and the dogs go ahead of them. The dog can hear a Japanese sniper in a tree 100 yards away, so they knock him out of the tree. Many, many American men were able to live, come home, contribute to society, create a family because of the dogs. They saved many lives in the Pacific. And if you watch this, and then you see that the Japanese learn that the dogs were real threats to them, they started shooting the dogs first, and then they flash back to one of the older gentlemen who was a Marine in one of these theaters of operation. And he says, after they shot one of our dogs, we really got mad. And you see the grit come out in this guy. And, you know, when he says we really got mad. But then you see other scenes in there that are going to rip your guts out. For example, one of the dog handlers, remember, these dogs were trained to kill, number one. They were ordinary dogs from households, voluntarily given to the military. They were trained to attack and kill by military dog handlers. They had to be trained to kill. So now they're trained to kill. They're brought out into the islands to help fight the Japanese in World War II. And so they're also trained to kill anyone who tries to hurt their handler. Talk about, you know, loyalty. They show one of the handlers getting shot. The Marine medic goes in to treat him. The dog lets the medic treat the handler. When the man dies, the dog suddenly becomes atavistic, growls, snaps, and threatens the Americans who want to come near the dead body. You look at a thing like this, and, you know, you have to understand, you have to own a dog to understand what this scene is. That the dog, trained to protect that man, will protect that man's corpse with his life. It's unbelievable. Then you see men whose dogs get killed who go to pieces. You see men feeding the dogs the last of their own rations. You see men giving the dog the last bit of food that they have. The dog becomes the last thing they have that they love in the world, in the middle of the hell that they were put. Then you see scenes of men who go to pieces. There was one scene in passing. I don't know if anyone's seen this last night. I had seen something like this once before in my life, of men who break down in combat. I saw this before. I may have seen it in passing in some of the in documentaries. But there was one scene that was astounding. Now, you're talking about the hardest men who were sent out into these island fights, hand-to-hand combat. The most horrendous, gut-tearing stuff you could ever imagine. We can only imagine what these men had to live through. I don't know if men could do this anymore. I really don't know if anyone could do it in the America of today. I truly don't know if they could do this anymore. I wonder if there are men left that could do this or they're all locked up in Pelican Bay. I'm not sure anymore. I watched this show, and you see a man who broke down from the combat, from the ugliness, from the horror of the blood and the guts and the killing and the murder. And he's crying like a baby, sucking his thumb. It's unbelievable to see this in the middle of this. And another Marine is holding him with his arm around him. And he's sitting there crying and shuddering like a baby, sucking his own thumb. He had a total crack up in the midst of this ugly, horrendous combat. Now, this was in passing. But, you know, we're talking about something else, which is the dog thing, the war dogs of the Pacific. But I'm bringing that up as a side note. Okay, so now the war ends. The Army shoots their dogs. You hear this? The Army decides that all the dogs that fought so loyally in World War II should be killed. They shoot all the dogs that they used. The Marines refused to go along with the program. In other words, in those days, they would not be obotomized. The Marines said, go to hell, we're not shooting our dogs, we'll shoot you first. So the Marines said, we're not shooting them. We're not going to go along with the Obama program of the day, in other words, just because Big Brother told us to. We'll shoot you first. We're not killing our dogs. They were our best friend. They kept us alive, dropped dead. So the Marine Corps backs up. The fat asses back home who decided to shoot the dogs suddenly, the fat asses back in Camp Lejeune who never fought, suddenly get frightened of the Marines and say, all right, we won't kill the dogs. Meanwhile, they have 540 killer dogs in their hands, and they don't know what to do with them. So you know what the men say? We will retrain them to become domesticated again. And they work 12, 15 hours a day, and they do teach old dogs new tricks, and they retrain them to be able to integrate back with families. So out of the 540 or so dogs that fought with the men in the Pacific who were killers, trained to kill, only four had to be euthanized. It's a story that is astounding, and I would highly recommend that you try to catch War Dogs of the Pacific on the Military History Channel when it's replayed, and I don't know when it'll be replayed. The historical footage and never-before-seen photos are astounding. And it was done by Harris Dunn, who was a graduate of the USC School of Cinema, and he earned a degree in film production. But he did, thrillers such as... family comedies, Bonjour, Buddy. But this feature documentary directing debut with War Dogs of the Pacific about the Marine War dog handlers of World War II is astounding. any dog lover should watch this, and it'll give you a new appreciation for not only the intelligence of dogs, the loyalty of dogs, but the devotion and the bravery and sacrifice of the United States Marine Corps. This is the Savage Nation. Phone number 1-800-449-8255. Let's go to Washington, D.C., WTNT. Jay, go ahead, please. What's on your mind?
Yes, Michael, I've been waiting for somebody to talk about this subject a long time. Actually, the one of the Marines that was instrumental in keeping those dogs from being killed was a gentleman named Colonel William Putney. Putney has a book you can read. It's called, of all things, it's called Semper Fi. It's about the third War Dog Company, and it discusses those many subjects that you've just gone over.
But he stood up to the Marine Corps brass and said, we're not killing them, I guess. That's what he had to do.
Correct. And his men loved him. All those families that got him. But he was alive up until about 4 years ago and passed away. But
You know, well, there goes the last, you know, where are they today? When they go and fight in Iraq, if they actually do the right job that they're trained to do, they get court-martialed by George Bush in the last administration and probably with Michael Mullen now in the Joint Chiefs of Staff. A guy's afraid to fire a gun without consulting a manual.
He would have been outed. I mean, he would have never been on the Admiral staff or flag officer back then. I don't really say, but this Colonel Putney, as far as I'm concerned, he should have got the Medal of Honor. But read that book, Semper Fi. And the one thing I want to
say, let me ask you, Jay, where is the dog cemetery that I saw at the end of the documentary? They apparently have a cemetery of these dogs somewhere. Where is that?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. I couldn't believe it.
It was an actual war memorial cemetery for these heroic dogs. It was unbelievable. Thank you for the call. Here we have a caller from Los Angeles who says he knew Colonel Lees.
Are you there, Dr. Savage?
Yes, sir.
Okay, yes, I knew Dr. Putney. Guam was where they have the statue.
In Guam, that's where the dog's cemetery is.
Cemetery there. I met Dr. Savage Dr. Putney when I was like 23 years old. He was 50 years old. We were the best of friends. We used to play golf together once a week.
What did he tell you about the whole dog program, Steve, that you could share with the audience today?
You know what? We became such good friends. I used to go. He had a dog kennel down in, let's say, Canoga Park that I used to go down with him all the time.
And I mean, this was after the war, of course.
We're talking 1973, 74.
So what I'm hearing is he continued his love for dogs into the latter part of his life, long after the war.
I think he passed away about 4 years ago. Yeah, he was a veterinarian when he passed away about 4 years ago.
Oh, he was a vet. The colonel was a veteran?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, was a veterinarian? The vet was a veterinarian?
Oh, yes.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, big time. He talked to
And Steve, did he tell you any stories of the war that would be worth sharing right now?
Yes. He says, you know, when we're out in the walking around in the bushes and everything else and leading dogs. He was so much the leader because he was the lieutenant. I think he went up to, like, captain or, you know, I don't remember. But, you know what?
That's okay. I'm going to tell – thank you very much for that sharing. Now he brought back a memory from the documentary. Let's just let him throw one more piece in. After the men had shown how good these dogs were in combat, they were rewarded with another stripe. They were moved up the ranks. And then the commander said to them, but because you've moved up from corporal, you can no longer be a dog handler because that's for a lower-ranked man. The men, almost to a man, ripped the stripe off their body and said, we'd rather remain a corporal in order to stay with our dogs. No, thank you. You can keep your stripe.
Savage.
Also on the Savage Nation today, how about dogs? We talked about the Westminster dog show, kennel show. We talked about, amazing stuff today, the montage on the president's dogs and the dogs like the Belgian sheepdog used during World War One, the toy poodle, which I have, Teddy, and many other things. We talked about, we played a wonderful soundbite of the story of a man named Fast Eddie, who was the lawyer for Al Capone and the mob, whose son was named Buck O'Hare, one of the great hero pilots of World War II, for whom O'Hare Airport is named in Chicago. It's an amazing story unto itself. And don't forget, we also had a long discussion today about the threat of an EMP blast and what that means and what it would mean to our government. What is an EMP blast? It's an electromagnetic interference against civilian and non-military government facilities, meaning all your computers would go down. All of it. And a suitcase or car-based EMP weapon could absolutely destroy data centers and all electronics in an area in the blink of an eye, which would cripple our economy and destroy information such as criminal records at the Justice Department or even all financial records on Wall Street. What are we going to do about it? Well, we had an expert on this and how to protect against it, because the fact is North Korea and Iran could detonate such an ONER nuclear weapon high above the atmosphere over the U.S. and literally send us back to the Dark Ages in 1 second. Did you know any of this? Well, you learned about it today on the Savage Nation, so there was a lot to talk about. I was watching TV the other night when Herb London from the Hudson Institute told a story about a gangster lawyer for the Capone mob named Fast Eddie. I didn't know where Fast Eddie came from.
I'm reminded of a story that I'd love to tell, about two people, one in the city of Chicago during the 1920s, who was a lawyer for the Capone gang, and he became the wealthiest man in the city of Chicago. You may probably have seen him portrayed in at least a dozen films, including Public Enemy. The lawyer, who was named Fast Eddie in Chicago, became enormously wealthy because every single time a member of the Capone gang was arrested, he would find some technicality in which to get him off. As a consequence, he became enormously well-known, very powerful, very wealthy, as I've indicated. On one occasion, he seemed to get a guilty conscience, stepped down his steps, and as he was walking down his steps, 15 bullets filled his body. He was gone. The Capone gang was not going to take any chances with Fast Eddie.
But here's the conclusion to the story. It's about Buck O'Hare, who is the namesake of O'Hare Airport, who happens to be the son of this lawyer to Al Capone.
Let me go fast forward, however, and talk about a man named Butch O'Hare. Butch O'Hare was a pilot during World War II. On the occasion when he was in the Pacific, he was sent out on a mission. However, he looked at his oil gauge in the middle of the Pacific, and he found he didn't have enough fuel to continue the mission. Radios his captain and says, "I have to return to the aircraft carrier." Captain says, "Go ahead." As he's going back to the aircraft carrier, he notices a squadron of Zeros about to attack the aircraft carrier. Instead of going back and landing, he decides he's going to attack the Japanese Zeros. With his machine gun, he takes out two planes.
Wow.
He runs out of ammunition, and he flies into two of the aircraft, knocking off a wing on one, a tail on the other, taking out four planes. Manages to limp back to the aircraft carrier.
Can you believe this?
He wins the Navy Cross as a result of this. 2 years later, in a mission in the Pacific, he is shot down over the Pacific, and he receives the Congressional Medal of Honor posthumously. If you have traveled to Chicago and go to Terminal 1, between Terminal 1 and Terminal 2, you will see the statue of Butch O'Hare, an airport that is named after him. It will tell about the heroic actions of Butch O'Hare. But what it does not tell you is that Fast Eddie was the father of Butch O'Hare.
Isn't that amazing? It just goes to show you that all is not lost. But you wouldn't know that from listening to Obama.
We've already made the largest investment in clean energy in history as part of the Recovery Act. An investment that is expected to create more than 700,000 jobs across America, manufacturing advanced batteries for more fuel-efficient vehicles, upgrading the power grid so that it's smarter and it's stronger, doubling our nation's capacity to generate renewable energy. And after decades in which we have done little to increase the efficiency of cars and trucks, we've raised fuel economy standards to reduce our dependence on foreign oil while helping folks save money at the pump.
You know, the president, Chairman Obama, talks a good game, but he still puts us in great danger by having terrorists tried in the U.S. But listen to Congressman Peter King of New York and his opinion on this.
This administration is just going in circles. They're the gang that can't shoot straight. They decided to put the trial in New York without ever talking to the police commissioner or the mayor. Now they realize they can't have it there. And they really don't know what to do, because if they try to put it somewhere else, obviously, you know, those communities are going to rise up against it.
Let's hope that's not the only reason they rise up. We talked about dog breeds today. I watched the Westminster Dog Show with my dog, Teddy, last night, and he was especially interested when they talked about his type of guy.
The toy dogs play a role that is much larger than the dogs themselves, for they are the true companion animals. They've been selectively bred for size and often for great style. Despite their small size, many of them are first-rate watchdogs.
I don't know about calling Teddy a toy dog. It's a shame they want to make some of them up, you know, some of these names. Some dogs have helped during American wars, and really well have they helped.
The Belgian sheepdog was used during World War I on the battlefield as a message carrier, ambulance dogs, and for pulling machine guns.
Some dogs have reached the highest levels of government.
President's Day is about our country's leaders. And as we pause for a moment to honor our presidents, let's hear it for their faithful companions, the first dogs. It is said that man's best friend is his dog. And in times of crisis, the love and companionship of a dog has given comfort and support to many a weary leader. And the tradition continues today. Bo, a young Portuguese water dog, is the latest presidential dog to call the White House home. There is only one, where 2,500 dogs vie to be best of the best.
And some of them might make better decisions than their masters.
Savage.